I like tuna. Tuna and episode of crackers. Yes.
We're rolling.
I like a scotch and, I like a scotch and episode. Oh, yeah.
You're truly an American.
American.
An American.
American.
Oh, I need to ring out my American.
Proud to be American.
It's long and soggy.
Up with pee because it's American and it's a pew thing. Sorry. I thought I had something.
I wear it as a cape.
Dr. Tar.
This is Professor Feather.
This is the Midnight Gadfly.
This is Dr. Head.
And this is the Bacon on Sizzly.
And we are bringing you, and you are experiencing.
Oh, yeah.
Maple syrup.
And I'm spent, like Michael Caine in The Hand. Fellow inmates, tonight we are going to talk about the Silver Age of comic books. That's right, the Silver Age. Little background on the Silver Age, generally considered from about 1956 to about 1970 or so, and what was going on before the Silver Age began, what was called the Golden Age. Superhero comic books began to decline following World War II. A lot of the comic books were like horror comic books, crime, romance. And then the book called Seduction of the Innocent came out in 1954 by Frederick Wortham, which I used to have a copy of, by the way, that said comics are bad, okay, because they led to juvenile delinquency. Reading causes delinquency, and then it brought in this whole new kind of self-guidance of comic books, the Comic Book Code Authority, and then because these books were no longer being printed, DC said, let's take some of these characters that we had that we've shelved for a long time and let's see what we can reinvent. Because at the time, it was only Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman on DC. Marvel was doing no superhero stuff.
Right.
And so Showcase number 4 comes out in October of 56. And then that was the reinvigorated Flash. Now we have, instead of Jay Garrick, we got Barry Allen. And that success of that book kind of sparked, like, well, let's kind of re-bring these other superheroes back out and kind of reinvigorate them, like the Green Lantern and so a new age was born. Doctor,
this is just for me. I don't know a whole lot about this, but is this just specific to like DC and Marvel when they're talking about the Silver Age? Or are they talking about all the genres, all the, you know what I'm saying?
No, the DC and Marvel were still two of the heavy hitters, but it was more about the era. Like, these are the books that were happening at this time, this era. So these eras are typically marked, not always, because the Bronze Age is a little murkier, but typically hallmarked with an event or a comic that comes out that kind of signals the end of an era or the beginning of a new era. And that's why the Showcase with Flash, the new Flash,
kind of said,
yeah, so it's basically a time saying,
because I was wondering about like the Golden Key, you know, like the Golden Key comics and Dell and that stuff.
Oh, those were still
I still remember a lot of that stuff. I read a lot of that because I was like all over with comic books. I just remember
Harvey continued. Dell was doing a lot of stuff. Gold Key with Classics Illustrated and Twilight Zone, the Disney titles, the Western stuff. And then Harvey had like Richie Rich and Casper and Little Bob. So it's more about the time than a specific publisher.
Right. Okay. I just didn't know if the term was actually, you know, just associated with like the big, you know, Marvel and DC. You know what I mean? Superhero, more superhero inclined type.
Well, that era did usher in a lot more superheroes because that's when Marvel really, Stan Lee took over Marvel in 61 and kind of brought the Fantastic Four. So it was kind of this renaissance of the superhero book. And while DC kind of maintained their kind of detached, like these are, you know, focusing on the heroes and or the powers, Marvel, of course, did the whole, like, we're going to talk about them as people and give them real problems. And, you know, that's the major difference. Yeah. But before I turn it over, it will begin. The one thing I kind of love and hate at the same time about the Silver Age is the silliness of it. As I was reading through some of these books, I mean, there are like issues of Superman or Action Comics where, you know, he's got to like Jimmy Olsen's like signed up Superman to make pancakes for like some kind of a charity breakfast or something. And so the cover is like Superman, like flipping like 500 pancakes, you know, like, and Batman has a time machine, you know, and like he goes jousting. I'm like, oh, come on. Really, guys, really? What the fuck, man? But
well, that explains the Gothic Batman graphic novel.
Well, that didn't, I mean, that Batman's change and predicated by, instead of Green Lantern, who, you know, Hal Jordan was all like, yeah, I'm a good guy, let's go do this, toward the end of Green Lantern's run. And again, this is a reflection of what was going on in the culture. We have, you know, we're dealing with Vietnam. We're dealing with presidents being killed, Martin Luther King being assassinated. We're dealing with upheaval, social upheaval. Comics began reflecting that zeitgeist little bit into a darker era. And so that's really kind of ushers the Bronze Age in the beginning, early 70s, when you see the return of the Gothic kind of stories to Batman. But before that, they're quite, you know, the Silver Age is bright and shiny and silly and nothing too serious happens. In the DC era, they started emulating Marvel. Like Marvel was like doing like really heavy hitting kind of stuff, like dealing with drugs and stuff like that. And then DC really like latches on, but it's so fake, it's so apey. Whereas, you know, at Stan Lee's direction, Marvel was just such more of an organic, you know, it felt natural. These, you know, Fantastic Four, these guys don't always get along. They fight. They love each other, but they fight and they leave and the team breaks up. I mean, stuff that, you know, Peter Parker can't pay his bills. You know, it's like these problems never existed for DC superheroes. And so
you never saw an episode, like, even though Barry Allen's version of The Flash was basically a CSI cop. So you imagine not making a lot but, you know, not making big money doing that. But you never had an issue of The Flash where he was wondering how he was going to pay next month's rent.
Yeah, even though they don't know he's The Flash and they're wondering, why are you late for your job? You know, and he's always running late. Right, exactly. The real life didn't come in. Wah. Yeah. And then with that, I will turn it over. Sizzlin' Bacon, you are a comic book aficionado. You're a comic book fish. tell me about your fishiness.
It's like you said, for me, the Silver Age started exactly. The Hays Code effectively killed superhero comics in the 50s. You know, Wortham had gotten parents so gaslit and up in arms that they were literally, I mean, you could find
them. They made this shit awesome.
Like book burning.
That's so cool.
Books that Hitler was trying to—they were all comic books, and so exactly the big publishers took the coward's way out, got rid of superheroes for the most part, and like as Dr. Head said, in the 50s, Marvel wasn't publishing any superheroes; they were publishing war and romance,
and westerns,
like little kid cartoons, and you know, the only real superheroes operating through that time were Batman and Superman, and that's basically because they were probably considered the most wholesome.
Because and Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman. Yes.
When was that? What year? I'm sorry.
And throughout the 50s. Into the 50s. I mean, yeah. I mean, those were the only three DC had done. And by the Marvel had checked out right after World War II because Captain America, like, okay, now we have no more Nazis to punch. What the hell is he going to do? And so they just basically, you know, literally put him in ice. So that was, and just a lot of those superheroes just kind of went by the wayside. And some of them ended up being absorbed into, you know, like Blue Beetle from and Captain Marvel from, you know, Fawcett Comics, and a lot of these, you know, went by the wayside, and DC and Marvel started like snatching them up, a lot of, especially DC, and you'll see the return of those characters in the Silver Age, you know, like Blue Beetle and that's just when superhero comic books really began to come back into fashion, because there were no more horror. They couldn't do horror anymore. Then romance, like, well, we need to have a different tack. So between the two of them, between Marvel's or DC saying, let's reinvent these characters, give them the same name or, you know, same character name, but different origins, and let's make these stories a little, you know, different. Yeah. And then Marvel, Stan Lee coming in, and Ditko.
Not Alan. Yeah. Now it's Hal Jordan.
Yeah, no, that kind of really ushered in the new era, the big wave of superhero books, which, you know, 70 years later, it's still going strong.
Right. But going back to the goofy stuff.
Yeah.
There was that. I do remember a lot of that stuff in the early 70s and stuff. Just the sheer goofiness of, you know, nothing more surreal than it was anything, you know, just the introduction of certain characters too.
Well, also too, like, that's also where you start to see the invention of characters that are just made to be goofy to make it more of a quote unquote funny book. You know, that this is the era where you get Mr. Mixia's Pitlick introduced.
Oh yeah, because
it's a prankster character. And this is when you get the Riddler introduced in Batman, because at the beginning, Riddler was just, he was kind of clownish. You know, his riddles were silly. He was basically a comedy villain until, you know, Denny O'Neill and, you know, the writers in the 70s decided to make him more threatening. But yeah, the goofiness, that was in... Until the counterculture started, because then those kids that were reading the comics in the early 60s when they were 10 were now in college, and, you know, Marvel smartly evolve up to the college kid age
and reading Wonder Warthog. So
yep. Oh, like Fritz the Cat, all that counterculture stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we also have, like, you know, Crumb. Those books were in, like, in the 60s. You know, we don't see other ones, like, with Harvey Pekar doesn't come out until later. But it was, I think, out of that movement. Because that was what was going on in the culture as well.
Everything was culture.
Yeah.
Had counterculture. You had
the look, the feel, the... Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Dell still put out horror comic books, you know, with Frankenstein. There was a Dracula one. There was a werewolf one. They still had, you know, kind of silly, campy superheroes, because Batman, they cannot underestimate or understate how
Robot big that Fighter.
Show was. You know, the 66 Batman live action, I mean, it was huge, colossal hit. And so DC at that time started aping the popularity of that book, and started dovetailing that into the silliness of the titles of the time. There was a marked change because Batman, the TV series, was so silly. Let's make the comic books just as silly, because we want to make, you know, readership, people who might like say, hey, the comic book's just as funny as the TV show. Which is what Marvel had done, I think, to a lesser success, like because of the success of like Iron Man and the Avengers movies. They started literally drawing their characters to look like them. Of course, that's a different era, but there were still a ton of stuff. Charlton comic books came out with a lot of characters, you know, Captain Atom and Judo Master, The Question, which then DC absorbed later on. We got Dr. Solar, Mana of the Atom, you know.
Oh yeah
Magnus, Robot Fighter.
Yep. Lost in Space. You guys remember? Yeah.
Yep.
Remember Lost in Space? Dell put out Lost in Space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Archie and it has nothing to do with the TV show, but it was just, yeah. I liked it when I was a little kid. I loved it. Mm-hmm.
I think for a time Dell put out Star Trek comics too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But basically.
Yeah. Had a couple of those. Yeah. UFO. Do you remember UFO? I picked up those. They were just like they, it was kind of cool because they, that was Dell, I believe.
Right.
But anyway, yeah. They, yeah, it was just, it was sightings or reported sightings. And then they would do this comic book illustration for each of them, which was awesome. I thought that was great at the time. Cool. That was so cool. Yeah.
Kind of like Project Blue Book, like, you know, the first.
Yeah. I mean, it was just a series of case files, but they were illustrated by. Yeah. So, which was like, yeah, you know, for when you were a little kid, that was even cooler. That was.
Yeah. And other titles were still going mega strong, like the Walt Disney line. Archie was going great. Because Archie sprang in superheroes too, like the Mighty Crusaders, the Comet, Fly Girl, you know, the Shield, which was kind of like a Captain America ripoff, the Jaguar, the Fly, you know. And because I remember the second iteration of those characters in the 70s, they brought those back out, Archie did. And that's when I first encountered them, along with like Charlton. You know, like there was a guy who was a monster hunter. He was Dr. Something. He hunted monsters. But I knew the quality of the books was vastly different. The artwork wasn't nearly as good, you know, but I still loved the comic books. But that was all due in response to the popularity of superheroes again. Like everyone was like, okay, superheroes are on the rise. Let's do something. I mean, even like Goofy became Super Goof, you know, in the Disney comics,
the anthologies with the the Vincent Price and the Boris Karloff titles, or in Twilight Zone title. Yeah, they all these
Dell
comics
put
like
all
that.
Those out. Dell had Boris Karloff.
I think about it. I read a lot of those. I went to a lot of those. Mm-hmm. Go figure. Just reflection there. Okay.
No, I. Yeah, that was Dell was always good for adapting. And existing,
and just weird stuff.
But like I said, they did. I think they might have even done a what was a Space 1999 book. Remember that show?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I think Dell did a version of that, if I'm not mistaken.
Who did? Did I just say this? Was it Golden Key or was it Dell? Who did Robot Fighter?
Magnus. That was Gold Key, I think, or maybe Dell, maybe both. Well, sometimes those comic books or the publishers would get multiple different characters. Like the Phantom was brought by King, Gold Key, Dell. I mean, you know, DC, Marvel both have published the Phantom, Intra Hall, an Indian print. You know, so I think they might have been borrowing, but I want to say Magnus might have been a Dell initially.
And I believe, to me, that would be a fun rework if you could do. Yeah.
Oh, Valiant Comics has already brought it out. They do. They do a Magnus. They bring it out, and from time to time, there's new Magnus lines. It doesn't last for a long time, but like a 4-part story, or
like the original.
They keep the character alive, and they kind of keep on revising, just like Solar, Man of the Atom, gets new life in the Bronze Age and in the Modern Age. So I think they don't want to lose these characters. You know, if you don't use it, you lose it. Yep. And that's one of the things that kind of happened. The big thing that DC did once when in like the 60s, they realized, okay, we have vastly different characters. We have this all new barrage of characters here. What are we going to do with these Golden Age versions of characters? You know, Superman, all these, you know, other Flash and other Green Lantern. And that's when they came up with the idea that there are different universes, like all of those characters that you remember reading in the 30s and 40s.
In the marketing aspect, that's awesome.
It's fantastic. And they started bringing that because Flash goes backwards or goes to the other reality, goes to the other world.
Also, too, with what you were just bringing up, too, what they did is when they split in and brought in the concept of an alternate universe, they took the Golden Age versions. DC took their Golden Age versions of Flash, Green Lantern, Hawkman, and they became the Justice Society of America, and that was in response to the Justice League of America book taking off and selling all of the copies. So your response was, let's do another book and let's repurpose, like you were just said, let's repurpose these Golden Age versions. And, you know, Barry Allen's not somebody who admired Jay Garrick, and since he got speed powers, he's the Flash. Jay Garrick existed as the Flash in this Earth.
In his own world, right, with Dr. Midnight and all these other characters? Yeah.
Plastic Man. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Is Plastic Man, is he a Golden Age hero or is he a Silver Age hero?
The first iteration of Plastic Man, I think, came in the 40s.
Yeah. Yep.
I believe, if I'm right. And then,
I'm pretty sure that it did too.
Yeah.
It's not that I follow this stuff a lot, but after reading a lot about it, I really like the character of Plastic Man.
Yeah, Dabney.
Yeah,
he's quite silly, and it was kind of also silly, the elongated man, and
people
and
are like scared of him.
1941
Like,
1941 is the Plastic Man.
41.
When he first popped.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know he went back that far.
I knew it was.
Well, 41, you're getting Aquaman, you're getting Captain America.
Because they made plastic.
Well, in that year, you get Plastic Man that year.
Yeah. And you see Plastic Man in the Elongated Man, and then also in Reed Richards. You know, those powers.
Marvel, the
plastics forever.
All the planets have powers, too.
What was that, Sithlin Bacon?
The current Miss Marvel in the comic books, Kamala Khan, that's Miss Marvel right now.
Mm-hmm.
She has stretch powers.
Oh.
And who could forget that. Stretch Armstrong?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And when you
should have made a Reed Richards like that, really.
That would have been very cool.
Yep.
If you think of some of the names, the big names that came out of this era, like as far as artists, we've got Carmine Infantino, who was really epitomized the early Flash, those early Silver Age Flash, gorgeous artwork. But then we've got Gene Colan, Steve Ditko, Gil Kane, Jack Kirby, Joe Kubert, John Romita. Yeah, I mean, big names that, you know, and then Chip Steranko. Neil Adams. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Steranko's History of Comic Books. I remember buying Professor Feather at Hidden Realms. I picked that up. I think it might have been Cosmicky told me. He said, you need to get this book. I'm like, okay, cool. You know, because he knew I was getting my masters in popular culture. And, you know, I still have it. It's a fantastic resource. So, yeah.
Unless we forget Bertie Wrightson.
Yeah. Rights and right with all the horror stuff that he was doing. He really came more into his fame in like the early 70s, I think. Rightson did with like Swamp Thing, Frankenstein.
Right was, we're leaving the Silver Age into the Bronze Age but he was illustrating books, and same thing, like some of those Dell comics had very illustrator quality covers, and Bernie Wrightson was doing that kind of thing. And those illustrated covers. Remember, Marvel used to put out a classics comics where they would tell like King Arthur in comic book form. And
those were still huge. Yeah. You know,
huge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, there's so many big books that came out in this era.
Big bold and breathy.
We see the first appearance of Martian Manhunter. In 1955, we get Lois.
That's an odd character.
We get Superman's girlfriend, Lois Lane, in 57.
And Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen, shortly after.
Yeah.
I liked the Superman variants, the whole family and menagerie. And
the Superman family with the
crypto, all the crazy.
And Kara, the Supergirl, her horse. And, well, it was just, you know, them.
Didn't Shazam kind of do that, though, beforehand?
Well, right. I mean, Captain Marvel had the Marvel family. Mary Marvel, Captain Marvel Jr., you know.
Yeah, that's right.
And wasn't there, like, critters that went with it, too?
But those are, of that era, I prefer reading Captain Marvel and Wiz Comics to the DC comics of the era, because there's a funness to the character, because he's a kid. I mean, Billy Batson is like an 8-year-old kid, and it's written like for 8-year-olds, and so I just love it, because it's so, it doesn't make sense always, but you got a villain who's a worm. It was like a 2-inch long. Yeah. You got a villain who's a worm, you know, like it's just like in a talking tiger. I mean, just like, it's just kind of delightful. And the newer versions, like when Shazam came out in the 70s, they really did a good job of capturing that spirit. You know, it wasn't all like serious. It was still like very silly. And so But I mean, the big books that came out, we got the first appearance of Legion of Superheroes. We've got Hal Jordan. We've got the Justice League of America. We also have the Avengers. We've got Hawkman, Hawkgirl, Earth 2.
The Defenders.
The Defenders.
Oh, yeah.
Hulk,
yeah.
Dr. Doom.
Silver Surfer.
Spider-Man, Ant-Man.
Black Panther.
Black Panther. Iron Man, Doctor Strange.
Where monsters dwell.
Professor Feather's favorites, Doctor Strange. That was 1963. We got the first appearances of the X-Men, Magneto. I mean, Daredevil, Teen Titans, Batgirl. I mean, this era of comic books is just filled, chock full of new and exciting characters. Not everything
I like. I like the silver. I call the Silver Age like the invention era. It was so inventive. It was coming out of that super clownish.
Okay, I'll take exception to that.
Well, no,
I don't think it was inventive. It was a paradigm shift in how comics were presented, which I don't care what anybody says. You can talk about DC all you want. Marvel came in.
That's where I was.
And totally changed comics forever. And you cannot give that, assign that to anybody else. They were the masters. And, you know, the artwork was key to that, because that artwork was as dense as what they were talking about. That artwork was, I lived through this. I watched this, you know, I read these comics straight off the presses and going, holy shit. You know, I like Batman. I like Superman.
I'm sorry. I'm just picturing Feather holding a hot comic. This is so fucking cool.
It was amazing, you know, and you guys all have the same sense, you know, for stuff.
Oh, no, yeah.
I was living at that time, you know, and that was such a shift and such a beautiful shift.
Right.
And it became really not just the artwork, but then they, you know, here we go. It's, soap opera. What are we missing? Let's bring in soap opera, the romance, that romance part too, you know. We'll mix that in. A la Peter Parker, you know. I really don't think that even Marvel would have sustained without Peter Parker. Peter Parker was the keystone to Marvel. They could do whatever else they wanted, but Peter Parker was pretty much that keystone, because Peter Parker appealed.
He was the key,
When did he come out? What year?
61, 62.
Yeah, I was 12. So. Okay. So I'm following him.
That was one.
I'm following him through my teen years. I'm following Peter Parker through my teen years. And I was a prime comic book reader, you know. So, absolutely.
You kind of grew up with him.
Absolutely brilliant.
You know? Right.
Well, Professor, do you ever find yourselves with characters, I don't know, some kind of how you identify with them? I don't care who or whatever media it was, but you kind of like attached to them at that time and you end up kind of like growing with them a little bit. Jerry, I don't know. That was just me.
But Professor,
I thought that was kind of weird. It was just, you just to stay that with Parker, but
right.
Yeah.
Where I was going, Professor Feather, was that's where I was going with what I was talking about being inventive. Marvel was the inventive thing of that era. So much so that DC, even though it had started a comeback by bringing back a new Flash, a new Green Lantern, the Justice League, Marvel, they were just rehashing their old shit, whereas Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Ditko and all those guys at Marvel, they became inventive with it. Because again, like you said, they invented of the concept of somebody with superpowers, but also has a soap opera type life. He can't find a girlfriend, or he can't keep a girlfriend. He doesn't know how he's going to pay the rent.
Explore the weakness to it. Yeah, just
can't afford it.
Humanize
Marvel.
That's where I was going with the inventiveness. That Marvel was so inventive that it shifted the entire world of comics, basically to a Marvel style. Because as Dr. Head said earlier in the podcast, DC started to ape what Marvel was doing because Marvel was having such massive success. Because Marvel figured out how to relate to its audience on a human level, not just a
It's more than that. That's just like one part of why Marvel was successful. They were successful because they had continuity. You get the little editor's notes, and then that spurred collecting because you wanted to be a completionist. You're like, fuck, I don't have that issue.
I got to go back to that issue
again. Right. Well, and like, we didn't have comic shops either. You know, we would sit there and we would run from drugstore to drugstore to gas station, and, you know, and they would never get the same comics, you know. So it would be crazy. But, you know, that's when we started to see certain things like Mile High Comics
That comes
the industry. But that came out of that because there was very little continuity in the DC stuff. You could pick up any issue and be right. It's pretty much
pick up this line.
Very little carried over into from one story to another. Yeah. One issue to another. You're right there. You're right there. Midnight Gadfly. And even beyond the continuity, beyond the making these characters feel like human, it was Stan Lee at the helm talking to you as the reader. Face front, true believers, and his Stan soapbox where he talked to you, the notes from the editors, you know, and like assistant editor month, like, oh my God, are we going to be able to survive this? You know, like letting the bullpen get it.
I imagine you say that.
All the artists working together in this room, like, oh my God, the artists are drawing, you know, writing, drawing. I'm like, they're all together talking comic books. I'm thinking, my God, it has to be the best place in the world. You know, nothing like that existed. But in my mind, it was this was a factory.
Yeah. Where, yeah. They talked
like
to me.
Wonka, like fucking Wonka's factory right here making comic books.
Dude, I think Floyd Ackerman kind of did that too when he, that was the charm of Famous Monsters too, was that. Oh, you know, talking to you. He's always talking to you, you know, Uncle. Yeah.
The only way to get back issues then, like, so the only way I read Spider-Man and Fantastic Four and I think the Hulk were those little paperback books that they republished them all in. And that's the only way you could
remember those.
You could read those at that time because you couldn't go buy them.
That was my first Spider-Man comic.
Little pocket,
Going back to the continuity thing, I mean, DC had an entire series that ran for decades, World Finest, which was Batman and Superman teaming up. But outside of that book, Batman, in the solo books, you never acknowledge that he really knows Superman or any other heroes. Superman books don't acknowledge him teaming up with Batman on a regular basis. But whereas Marvel, when two characters would team up in somebody's book, again, that's where we come with the invention of the editor's note. They let you know, this happened, because in a later issue, that character is going to mention, hey, I teamed up with Daredevil.
They keep track of the chain here. It's just that web. And
Daredevil issue number 214.
Brilliant marketing,
That's what I just said.
Brilliant. Like Feather said, that was brilliant. That they were able to do that to make people, now I know exactly, if I want to see the story they're referring, I know exactly where to find it.
And then as Gadfly said, how the hell do you find it?
right.
But think about that, too. Here we go. Our moment of Zen, you know, that journey in itself is a good memory.
Yes.
You know, of trying to track it down. You may not even find it. Mm-hmm. The memory of that you're doing that. And that, powerful. That's powerful.
There was also, I think. The way they publish magazines is if they had any left over, they would get credit by taking the covers off and sending them back. Yep. And we'd go to this place called Sunshine Corners, and they'd have a bag of three of these coverless comics. So I read a ton of comics, never knowing what the covers looked like. You know, so I would say the majority of the comics I owned had no covers.
I used to go to flea markets, the coverless comics. I'd find them in flea markets in like 7-10. It's like 10 for a dollar.
Hey, I heard Feather upstairs there, though. But when you said the hunt, when it was the hunt for it, you know, you had to go look for it. You kind of knew it was around, and you're kind of keeping an eye if it does come around, and just everything. Yeah, fun. That was
almost like a scavenger hunt. Like, is almost more fun than actually finding the things.
Yeah, and it's I kind of akin it to when you ordered something, and at the time you just had to wait. You know, like if you ordered something out of a comic book, you had to fucking wait.
Yeah.
You know, it could be like a month or whatever the fuck it
my
was.
My secret Dakota like, ring, right?
Yes! Yes! It's like, oh, is it here? No.
Yeah. No, I had a binder.
Seriously.
I had a physical binder that I had typed up the numbers like 1 to 900 and some in these tiny little columns, and my dad made copies for me at work. And I would have a little spot for, you know, I'd write the name of the comic book on top, and I would highlight the issue numbers that I had of the, you know, not really knowing that some were like monthly, bi-monthly, quarterly, you know, thinking at the time when I was really getting into it. And I would take this binder with me to flea markets, and I would be like looking through the quarter comic book bin and have my book open like, oh, I don't have Spider-Man 273. Sweet. I'll pull it out, you know. And that's how I would like fill bags and bags of comic books, and I'd take them home. You know, but that was part of the fun. It's like, I have this now. I can read this now, you know.
The first time you go into an actual comic shop, I didn't even know they existed. And we were – Southwick Mall had this section at one time called Old Town.
Magic Town was there too, or Magic – whatever that was.
But it looked like an old-time streets, you know, with the shops in them and stuff.
Yeah,
and you had to – we rounded the corner – and there was that fucking comic shop that that we ended up going to all the time. And I just fucking lost my mind. I'm like, there's a whole store full of fucking comics.
Look at those. There's long boxes full of comics. Yes. Wow, what does that mean? Who would have thunk it? Yeah. Who would have thunk it?
Yeah. I would go to flea markets. There was a guy inside who had probably, he probably had, maybe 100 long boxes
Full
of comics. And it was all like 3 for $1. And I would fucking fill up, you know, a whole garbage. I'd get my $100, buy a, you know, a garbage bag, fill up a paper bag full, you know, a grocery bag full. And Professor Feather, it was Hidden Realms was the first comic book store that I'd ever been in.
Oh, really?
I always bought them either at flea market or to the drugstore.
Interesting.
You know, because I'd never, there was no.
Your first virgin, yes.
No comic book stores around me. It was just like, oh, a comic book store. I have to go check this out. Because, you know, I was buying them at flea markets. If I saw them, like, that was it.
My clue's leading me here. Yes.
Yeah, it was just like, and it just happened by accident. So I was just walking downtown. I'm like, what the fuck? Hidden Realm, comic books and gaming. Oh my God. I had to like make sure I didn't have a boner. I'm like, okay, let's go.
Dude, I was running from the China Village.
Right.
I know. I was running past and that's how I saw them. They just literally fucking opened up and it was like, oh, I didn't know we had a comic book shop.
Yeah. No, I get you, Gadfly. The fact that there was a comic book store, because I wanted to order Mile High, but you know, I think I never had enough money to really put down and buy.
And the proprietor actually liked the fucking movies I like too. It's like, oh, this is fucking cool.
Yeah. But why the Silver Age resonates still for me, as goofy as it is, it still reminds me there's still a childlike appreciation for the art form, for comic books, that it doesn't take itself too seriously, doesn't ask a lot of the reader. And that still resonates with me, like as much as
entertainment. I'm more of a Bronze Age.
Yeah, Bronze Age is more my sweet spot because that's when I was like old enough to really appreciate comics, and I was really reading in the late 70s, early 80s. That was where I was really reading most. But that love for comic books was really invigorated by finding like reprints. Like those 100-page DC would put out these 100-page reprints that were all these like golden and silver age stories. And that's how I was reading like the first appearance of the Joker or the first appearance of Catwoman or whatever, you know. And like, so for me, that was exciting and thrilling. Like, oh my God, these look so different, you know.
Does the larger, I guess it's not considered a comic book, is it? The larger format things, you know, like Conan, you know.
They called them digests so that they could get away with publishing those without the comics code, and they could be more violent or maybe have a little.
Well, I was thinking the Marvel, you know, when they had the magazines and stuff.
Yeah, they had the
size.
Yeah, they called.
Are those considered comics? I guess they're not considered comics.
They're considered magazines. I think like Curtis Publishing did a lot of the vampire, the zombie, witchcraft books. They also Marvel had a magazine imprint in the 70s.
I remember those. 70s. I love those. I thought those were
epic. Yeah. They were like Rampaging Hulk.
Yeah,
epic magazines. Also, you had a Punisher magazine, and you had the savage sort of Conan. And like I said, Booms and Marvel did those in that form, is because then they could do comic book stories, but get around the comics code that was very restrictive in the censorship.
I remember Frankenstein being a little racy at the time. That was
You could see some cleavage and maybe a nip.
Well, but you
know, they were talking about other shit too.
You can have some naughty language. You could have the you could have more realistic violence.
And it was 70s. I remember, like, it had it was that sleazy Al Adamson kind of feel to it.
That was like that kind of movie. Age.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gadfly, you were saying something right before that. Sorry.
Oh, I don't remember. Sorry. I lost the thought.
No. That's all good. There's something. I mean, once we get to the Bronze Age, things begin to get serious, and then we don't see another really change in comic books to the modern age till like 86. That was another demarcation. But by then, you know, I think the bloom had fallen to some degree, and now we start moving into the era of like collecting in the early 90s, you know, where we got 30 variant covers of this and that. And I fell victim to it. I admit it. I got suckered and pulled into it.
Late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm. I got suckered in on one, and I actually still have the book that I got suckered in, the two books I got suckered in on that.
I was always looking for like just weird ass shit. I asked Feather about this. It was always, it didn't necessarily need to be mainstream stuff. I kept asking about weirder stuff, but
it's the beauty of having a comic book store.
I know, right? And I kept asking.
You get access to a lot of different styles.
Oh no, shit! Yes,
people wouldn't normally.
And I can, I think that's where the idea where we connected on the B movie shit, because I kept asking about things like along those lines or cult movies or. Yeah, it was how the shop evolved. Well,
like a way like out that. From the comic, like Howard Chaykin's American Flag. You would have never found that on a spinner rack at a drugstore.
No, you would not. You found it in my first store, though.
In a comic book store was where
I had a comic book store when First was big.
Yeah.
And I had every First comic that they made. Because I thought they were some of the best going stuff. Still good. You go back and read them, and they still hold up quite well. Quite well. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, that's a whole different era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, because you had that. You had the book. Was it a previews that you could like literally? It was like a catalog. Yes.
Yeah.
Every month, and you whatever could like see everything was coming out. I'm like, my God, you didn't, because I never saw those comic books until I was in your store, Professor Feather.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of Nexus. I'd never heard of Concrete. Yeah. I'd never heard of these other. I mean, the
Electronic Films. Why?
Like Charlton was about as far away removed from standard like deviation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the quality wasn't as good. Dell, I knew about
movies.
You know, Fawcett. You know, but you know, Archie comics, those kinds of things. But you know, Marvel and DC were the only things that where I was looking at our local grocery store or comic books.
That's all you'd ever see.
Oh no, that's not true. Yeah. That's not true. Because I looked
Archie comics.
Yeah, right. No,
Archie. Yeah, and that was it. But
back in Batman and Superman, and that was kind of it.
Yeah, that's it. And it's because of the popularity of the Silver Age is why we had such a big movement too in the underground market, and these other publishers were allowed to, you know, now people could actually get them and like be exposed to them, like you, Professor Feather, like you had those First comics. I know you, what was it? Oh God, there was one that you really liked from First. Fuck, I don't remember. I don't remember the guy, but
Grimjack.
Other than
Grimjack.
Yes, You know, again, first exposure to these Badger. My first exposure was if I were to tend to see them like at a flea market, I would probably look right past it because I'm like, what the fuck is this? But it was through the store, through being educated and like getting exposure to these and like checking them out.
Educated.
Like, oh, well, it really was. It was an education because all I saw was the mainstream.
Yeah.
And It's like if you don't know how good it is and you've never tried it before, you're probably not going to try. You just know what you've been reading.
Were the spankings necessary?
Well, that was just a bonus from the store. Buy a comic, get a spanking. I'm like, all right.
Oh, Steve Doms. I'm sorry.
Badger was my favorite thing out of first.
Yeah, I love Badger.
Badger reminded me is like, what if Wolverine ate bath salts?
Good writing, good art.
Stephen Butler's art on that.
Because his immune system would kick in and like 2 seconds later, it's like, oh, what was that?
I met Stephen Butler just a few years ago, and he's a complete asshole.
He was just
you could tell he fucking hated being there and talking to comic fans.
I had that with Joe.
That's terrible.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
He would just sit there and say, are you going to buy this? Are you going to buy this?
One of the years that I had a table at Akron Comic Con, they sat me next to Joe Rubenstein, and I was excited because at the time I was really wanting to ink over other artists' pencils, and he was a total cockbag. It's like I was excited, and then within a half hour sitting next to him, I'm like, can this weekend be over now?
Mike was that Green Lantern artist, Sizzlin' Bacon? We went to the first Akron Comic Con. The guy was so nice and spent so much time with you and gave you wonderful feedback.
Yep.
He was so nice. He did the Green Lantern. God, what a nice guy.
I got yelled at.
Jerry Conway, those first couple at Akron. Jerry Conway was really nice.
Batman.
Jerry Conway.
Superman, Spider-Man comic book. I talked to him.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, know who was the coolest at all those conventions and actually gave me the most really constructive criticism for my art was Norm Breifogel.
Oh, yeah. He was there, too.
One of my favorite Batman artists ever. And he sat with me for hours. Like, before crowds would show up, he'd say, let me see your portfolio and just go through it and say, hey, I like this. I really like that. You could do this a little better. And the whole weekend, like, he's like, yeah, bro, show up early. And I'll go over
He did not charge for autographs, Norm Breifogel. Not at all. And same thing with Gene Colan, or, you know, nothing. Yeah. And I even asked him, I said, what was your favorite story? Do people still get mad about, you know, you killing Gwen Stacy? And he's like, oh, yeah, I still hear it to this day. not Gene Colan. Oh, who was it?
Conway.
Colan.
I go, well, then what was your favorite story you wrote? And he goes, The Death of Gwen Stacy. I'm like, okay, nice. But he was in a room by himself. There was no one there. I'm like, okay, let's go talk to him. And he just spent as much time as I wanted. It was so, everyone was so nice, you know, just so nice and gracious with their time. See, that's what I love, that they still love the comic. They love the form, and they took the time to make everyone feel special, and that was just great.
I got yelled at on the phone by Mike Grell for about 10 minutes. He didn't know it was me. He thought it was the publisher of the book he was doing, and he was complaining about me because I was an inexperienced colorist, and how dare they put an inexperienced colorist on there. I finally got to interrupt him, and I go, Mr. Grell, that's me you're talking to, the colorist that they hired. He goes, oh, click.
What's wrong with your coloring, did that gadfly?
He just didn't, it wasn't the problem with my color.
Apparently what he wanted.
Yeah. He didn't want somebody as little experience as me because he was a big deal, you know, in the industry.
Yeah.
So it was just, you know, him complaining about that. And, you know, and then, okay. Well, he... The whole publishing thing took a dive anyhow. You know, there was Stroman and Thurman. They went off on their own from Image, and because they were making like $1 million for books, you know, with all of the sales and stuff, they just went off and did their own stuff and didn't do it very well.
Yeah. Well, Grell was at one of the places I went to. It might have been. I don't know if you were there. Probably not. It wasn't Comic Con Bacon. It was maybe the one in Cleveland, because there was a lot bigger artists there. Herb Trimpe was there,
Herb Trimpe. That was
what was that?
That was Cleveland.
Yeah,
when it was Wizard World in Cleveland.
Wizard World. Yep. Right. That's where I won a copy of the Dark Knight Returns. One of Frank Miller's, like, from his personal library, his like his actual copy of Dark Knight Returns, like book 3, I think, or something like that. And but anyway.
We met Neil Adams there in Cleveland too, and Neil Adams gave me some art tips too. He looked at some of my stuff and was.
Did he charge you?
Oh, that's because cool. He charged.
You know what? That fucker was charging for a 30-second sketch, like $800.
Yeah.
What?
I bought. Okay. I'm
serious.
That's good for you.
Yeah, I bought 3 of them.
I
see him. I got him over here.
Well, no, yeah. I
have a couple of pre-orders, but
that
was.
He had a deal, like, if you bought, when we met him that first time, if you bought 3 of these 11x17 prints, and you buy 3 of them for $50 and he'd autograph them. So I did. I bought 3 prints and autographed them. But as we were talking, I told him,
Tom, you better fucking draw something back there.
Oh, I told him I was an artist, and
drawing my name.
I was an artist, and I'm always trying to learn new stuff. And he asked if I had anything, and I showed him a couple sketches I had in my backpack, and he was real cool. He didn't like.
Oh, very cool.
He gave me. He's like, he's like, same thing. He this is a good breakdown. This has worked. This needs work. This is real good. Do more of that.
I stalked John Byrne at a convention.
He didn't like try to keep me away or anything like that. He was, I'll look at your stuff. It's like he liked looking at art so he could say, okay. It felt like he liked being helpful. Like he knows who he is.
Exactly.
Now I can help somebody that has a talent but needs maybe a button push. And I'm going to try to find that button push for them by saying, hey, this is good, but you could do it a little better. And that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I thought you met John Byrne.
Oh, I stalked him at a convention because he was buying comics, not at his table. And I just wanted to see what comics he was buying. So he was buying a bunch of back issues of the Defenders, the original Defenders.
All right.
And, he had what was the other one that I kept seeing him look at? It was another team book. And I think it was DC or something like that. I just don't remember exactly. But it was pretty funny. I'm like, I thought he'd be taller. But yeah, I didn't talk to him. He was, I don't like interrupting people when they're walking around. If he was at his table, I would have talked to him, but and then the only time the only time I ever got starstruck was with Roger Zelazny. I just looked over and he's standing next to me.
Oh,
and he looks at me like, are you going to say something? And then he just smiles at me and I walk away. Like your books.
Yeah, it happens.
What did he say?
I like to read your books.
first time I met Stan Lee, I was like that. I was, I like writing your book.
Yeah, I met him just one time. It was nice. He was cool. I mean, you paid. It was the meet and greet. But
I know. See, now I met Stan in the 80s. That's when Columbus had the Mid-Ohio Con, and Stan just sat at a table with, like, Marvel just had a long table. They had different artists and writers. Stan was right in the middle. You could just walk right. There was no paid meet and greet.
Really? Jeez.
At the table, you could go up and talk to him.
Wow.
Meet and greet sounds like some kind of porn thing.
M-E-A-T. Yeah, well, this when I saw Stan, it was one of those bucket list things I had to say hi. I gave him a copy of Grammar Man I just wanted to thank him. He said, Spider-Man is what really got me fell in love with comic books. I mean, I'd literally been reading them as long as I could live, and he thought Grammar Man was pretty cool, and it was I just wanted that minute. I just wanted that moment just to say thank you. I appreciate it. You made a huge impact in my life. Thank you so much. I just wanted that, and I got it.
I would have been like, did you get my letters? Why the fuck didn't you respond?
I still want to marry you, Stan Lee.
And his response was, here, I'll give you a no prize.
And Stan has like a 10-foot pole still holding it. It's like, all right.
Yeah.
I love that. The no prize.
Those were awesome. Like people coming in, hey, I noticed that the color of Daredevil's head was yellow when the rest of his bodysuit was red. Oh, here you go. Win a no prize. What a great way of handling those like errors and the people who are like pointing out those things. And it kept the Marvel bullpen and the editors on their toes.
Yeah.
You know, but in a fun way. It was
in
like,
a fun way. Oh, no. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You felt a part of the community. As a front true believer, you felt like you were involved.
That let them know how aware people are of this. And it's just
As it moved along, and you're right, it all became a matter of continuity, too. Yeah. And that universe, and then, you know, making, you know, using that universe as, you know, different areas to intertwine, you know, and DC, there again, that's not Silver Age. We're beyond Silver Age when we start talking about DC, I think. Marvel left DC in the fucking dust. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
They did.
DC did not really begin to catch up until the late 80s.
No.
They started doing like Sandman, Shade the Changing Man, Swamp.
It was Batman. I never really read Batman.
Yeah, the English Invasion was a big part of that.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, those
writers. That's going into a whole different era.
Yeah, we're already running long.
We're running long. Good.
We were talking about the bullpen, though, man.
We're running long. Yeah, we're running long.
This is such a happy ending. Yeah.
Just like the happy end of the Silver Age. Yeah. Is there anything?
And we are silver for the most part. Yeah.
I still love this era. I do. It just makes me feel connected to my earliest roots of why I enjoy comic books. There's still a childlike quality that I appreciate. Again, a lot of the stories are terrible.
Oh, no.
When I was reading through Marvel and DC, I was really ready to be done with Silver Age when I was done. I'm like, Jesus, I'm really tired of the fucking time travel, Batman. You got to stop going back and fighting as a knight. Be Batman, please. You know?
Variations.
Get back into the Bronze Age, which we'll come to down the road. We'll do some talking about Bronze Age down the road. But now I'm spent like Michael Caine. Well, I think I've said it.
Yeah, just toss that sock aside.
The Silver Age sock.
Yeah, this song is by Head Fock Productions.
Oh, yeah. Fuck your head.
Fock. Head Fock.
Oh, sorry. Dyslexia.
It is. The title is called Techno Music.
That's just lazy writing.
It fucking is.
Meanwhile, the Northern Ireland pub.
And you have been experiencing
Tune in next episode, true believers.
Meet and greet. Happy ending.
Use both hands, please.
Yeah, our next episode, Sizzlin' Bacon's going to be leading. It's going to be a little exploration of toking and smoking and a little cheech and chonging.
Join us in the van.
And lots of joking.
Join us in the
joint
van.
Joint us in the van.
Enough said.
Dr. Head won't be talking much because he's driving.
That's right. But I'll be high.
I always have to drive.
He's going to be sitting up there doing this monologue that's constantly going. And as he's driving, he's flipping a 5-pound sledgehammer with his right hand, constantly catching it. Oh, wait a minute. Somebody else did that. Sorry.
That's no sledgehammer. Oh.
This is a very old van. It's got shag carpet in the inside. It's got swivel chairs, even for the driver. So that's why we got to watch Dr. Head and keep him face forward.
No black lights allowed. It's like a fucking hazmat scene in the back.
Yep.
Has anybody seen Dudes of Hazmat?
No.
It's actually kind of funny.
Okay, I'm sorry. UnsaneRadio@gmail.com. Unsane Radio is on Facebook. UnsaneRadio.com. Go and look at the pictures there. If for no other reason, look at the pictures. And then listen to an episode here and there. We got a whole scad of them out there. Tar and Feather. TarandFeather.com. I don't have any idea what's happening with that site because
we're in the ether.
He was going to redo it, but I haven't seen anything yet.
Oh.
So I'm just waiting. I wasn't being, casting aspersions.
Oh, aspersions were then, cast.
We have a YouTube channel, Tar and Feather Psycho Cinema. You can come. We have a few movies up there. More to come.
And Heavy like Metal Horror on Facebook's Heavy Metal Horror Podcast. And on the YouTubes and Instagram, Montag Lewis, one word, Heavy Metal Horror. We begin our new season on VD. Valentine's Day is coming up. Our very first episode is going to be with Richard Clark and Kane Bacadin
of
Among These Ashes. We're going to be doing a slugfest.
Valentine's Day.
We're going to be two titans of horror. We're going to do Dawn of the Dead versus Return of the Living Dead. That's right, coming up soon on Heavy Metal Horror.
That's pretty good.
It's a foreign format. I love the slugfest format. Yeah. Susan Bacon, where are you going to be swimming? Gadfly, where are you stripping?
Oh, no. I got a new modeling job. As a VD model. Yeah. How coincidence.
Is it the before or after picture?
Yeah, both.
Veterans degraded.
I'm getting paid extra to contract.
Coming up nicely.
Yeah. Vegetarians.
Yeah.
Man only.
I didn't get a contract, but I contracted something.
He's modeling. My words!
He's modeling his VD on his panel.
Well, I hope it's only.
We're on OnlyFans. Fan only. Fan only, yeah.
VD modeling and egg swapping.
Body surf the dwarf.
Fate fucker.